One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com. Life is full of what ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
That's... Yeah. They have asked for that, really.
You can laugh. It was the World Cup.
I'm a little bit of an idealist. But having said that, I want to be like me.
I don't know about the rest of you, but I blame Owen Hargreaves for this one. You can't go around predicting a 7-goal thriller like he did directly before a big match. This is the problem with the pre-match hype. When pundits openly predict a 4-3, then a perfectly decent 1-0 final ends up feeling like it's shortchanging, even though it wasn't that bad. Thomas Tuchel knew better. He said, "I had the feeling that maybe the first goal decides this match." The PSG coach was correct, but the goal was scored by Bayern Munich, who are champions of Europe for the sixth time in their history. Welcome to our Champions League final podcast. Hi, Ken. Hi, Kieran. Good to be back. How are you guys? How are you, Ken?
Good to have you back.
Hey, Owen. Welcome back.
Nice to be all together again. Did you guys enjoy the game?
Yeah. I enjoyed the first half.
Yeah, the first half was good. There was a few too many fouls in the game, generally, I think. There was like just there seemed to be more niggly fouls in the middle of the field than was strictly necessary for a game of this standard. But yeah, the first half was good.
I thought the first half was really good. As in, I thought it was one PSG miss away, or you know, failed chance away from potentially really catching fire. If they'd scored one of those goals when they had a flurry of chances in the first half, I think we could have been looking at the classic that Owen Hargreaves and many others predicted, Ken, but that didn't happen, and Bayern kind of squeezed them in the second half.
Yeah, I've seldom ever seen a game that unfolded so precisely as had been predicted beforehand. You know, in terms of every preview of this game that I saw talked about the same thing, which was, Bayern Munich are, Bayern Munich are incredible. They're an unstoppable team. It's the Bayern train. They've won 20 games in a row. This is going to be 21 wins in a row. It's like 34 wins out of the last 35 or something crazy like this. They haven't lost since December 7th. It's unbelievable. They won every single game in 2020 apart from one game, and they'll draw against Leipzig. Now who can stop the Bayern train? But does the Bayern train have any weaknesses? Well, there is this one issue where they like to play with their defense up around the halfway line. This had been a problem we saw against Lyon. It wasn't really a problem against Barcelona. You know, ultimately what's Luis Suarez is going to do, you know, if he's got to run 50 yards to get near goal, he's not going to do anything. You know, Lionel Messi's not going to do anything. But Leon, they had, you know, Memphis Depay up front. He can shift a little bit. And so they, if you remember the game between Bayern and Leon, had four chances in the first 20 minutes before Bayern scored a goal to score, all of which they missed. But the point is that the chances were created. And if you were Hansi Flick, the Bayern manager before this game, you have got a serious dilemma there. You know, it's like, do I stick with what we've been doing? Because the train has built up unstoppable momentum. And, you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Or do I take account of the fact that tonight we are going to be coming up against the two best counter-attacking forwards in the world in Neymar and Mbappe? Because, you know, it's one thing if the Lyon forces Depay or Akambi get in and have a chance. Okay, they missed against us, but surely if it's going to be Neymar and Mbappe, they are not going to miss those chances. You know, and then you're left with this dilemma of, okay, what's going to happen? You know, if we play the same way and if the game unfolds in the similar sort of pattern and they do get the same chances we coughed up against Lyon and they score them, which they will, then I'm going to look really foolish. Everyone's going to turn around to me and say, you know, Hansi, there was a lot of good things about this train. You know, it had a very powerful engine, lovely wheels, nice red coat of paint. The only thing, Hansi, this train was missing was a driver that could stay awake at the wheel. But unfortunately, you couldn't do that. You somehow didn't see it coming, that leaving Neymar and Mbappe 50 yards behind your defense to plant it was going to maybe be a problem. You, for some reason, couldn't see what the entire world had been telling you was going to be a problem. Because it's not a stone. Nobody mentioned this, Hansi. Literally 200 languages around the world. You know, the articles have been written talking about your high line and how this could be a problem. And do you change? And so Hansi, I think, probably actually had to toss and turn a little bit on this one. Because it's easy to say, okay, well, of course I'm not going to change something as fundamental as like that line, because where, you know, if our defenders are pushed right up to halfway, then that reduces the amount of space they have in midfield. That's what enables us to put pressure on them to win the ball back quickly, to deny them space, to starve them of possession, and to inflict our game. And so I'm not going to change the basis of our game. And yet, when you look at how obvious the weakness appears and how... you know, how exposed you would be, there must be a temptation to change it. So Hansi might have thought, well, you know what, I could end up looking really, really stupid if we lose that way. What's the one thing worse than looking stupid while losing? That's right, Owen. Looking clever, or trying to look clever while losing. That's the only way this can be worse for Hansi Flick. If Hansi decides... just at the last moment, just to, you know, within sight of the cup, to start meddling with a winning formula, if he suddenly decides that he's going to like double mark all of the PSG forwards and, you know, he play with nobody up front, or, you know, three fullbacks or something creative like this. And suddenly Bayern are looking at each other going, oh, what are we doing? We don't understand all of the things we've been doing. We've thrown them away. We've balled it. We've second guessed ourselves. That's the only way that losing could be worse than losing. You know, so it reminded me a little bit, actually, of I was thinking, Wayne Rooney had written a column, his Sunday Times column is actually often very good. I shouldn't sound so surprised. It's nothing about Wayne Rooney. It's just that oftentimes footballers' columns are not that, you know, not that interesting.
You don't get the sense that they always... sometimes they don't have much to say. Oftentimes they don't necessarily... want to spend enough time and effort thinking of interesting things to say, whereas Rooney actually seems to have a point of view.
He does, you know, and he puts in, you know, he wrote an interesting preview of this where he talked about a lot of the same issues, but he built a fairly convincing case that PSG had a great chance of winning the game, and you know, it was on this issue of that dilemma. And I was thinking of a column that he'd written a few weeks ago where he talked about the 2011 Champions League final. And it was quite interesting because that was, as you recall, Man United against Barcelona, the second Man United-Barcelona final they'd previously played each other 2 years before in Rome. And when they played in Rome, Barcelona had sort of a class. Man United was one of those games where it was frustrating. They couldn't really get, they felt like they didn't really lay a glove on Barcelona. You know, they just sort of got outpassed, and it was like, you know, shots from outside the box by Ronaldo. And, you know, you walk off the field thinking, we were hoping to retain the European Cup. They would have been the first team to do that since Milan, I guess. At that point, Real Madrid have obviously done it since. And we felt like we haven't really given a proper account of ourselves, and it was... It's frustrating to lose a game like that. 2011, they come back. And if you recall, Alex Ferguson before this game was like, you know, we are Manchester United. You know, the great attacking traditions of this club. And he was, he basically said, we're going to play our game and let them worry about us, which was kind of funny from Ferguson. You know, he's talking about the attacking traditions of Manchester United, when in fact, if you looked at their recent European tradition, it had been based on this amazing defense that they had. Mm-hmm. You know, they didn't let it go from like one end of the season to the other. For Van der Sar had this insane clean sheets minutes record. I think he set a new one in Europe. But suddenly Ferguson, the lead up to the Barcelona game, was all, oh, this club is George Best, Bobby Charlton, Dennis Law, Eric Cantona, Lee Sharp dancing by the corner flag. That's what Manchester United is all about.
Stop banging on about Lee Sharp, boss.
You just couldn't shut him up about Lee Sharp's samba corner flag dance. So that was basically the team talk. Just a video of Lee Sharp doing that, and then, come on, lads, you know what to do. This was the way that Ferguson was sort of selling it in public anyway. But, you know, it seems he was doing a bit of that in private as well, because Rooney, in his column a couple of weeks ago, was saying that he heard this and immediately thought, oh, no. You know, he had, obviously, Ferguson and Rooney, I wouldn't say necessarily are... they don't have the closest relationship in football these days, I'm sure. Rooney certainly wasn't afraid to criticize Ferguson a little bit here, but he was just saying, it's ridiculous. Like, when I heard that, I thought, well, you know, how does he, is he serious? We can't play that way against this team. You know, if we do that, if we try to go toe to toe, let them worry about us, they won't worry about us for a second. They'll just take us apart. We can't do that. We need to develop a game plan to try to shut down their strengths. Now, Ferguson had written a letter to the editor. I'm sure his letter would have gone something like, Mr. Wayne Rooney writes in his column that, you know, we didn't do it. Well, in fact, I did. And part of that plan was telling Wayne Rooney to try to get in, you know, try and sit in Sergio Busquets and stop him running the game from the back of Barcelona's midfield. But of course, Wayne Rooney forgot about all that. And that was one of the first reasons why we ended up losing the game that day. Anyway, the point is that you can be... you can try to do things a number of ways, but I think Ferguson realized, look, if we lose to these guys, you know, I don't feel there's much I can ultimately do to shut down the strengths that this team has. The players are too good. You know, we don't want to necessarily relitigate the 2011 Champions League final here, but I do think there's a bit of a connection there between what Ferguson did and what Flick did. It's like, okay, they've got amazing players, really obvious strengths. I could try to change my team's system to negate those strengths, but even if I did, I don't think it would work. I can't be sure. They could still end up, you know, beating us with the same strengths anyway. So what's the point? What's the point of undermining ourselves in order to try to counteract them? So let's just go with it and hope that today it's going to be our day. And Tuchel, I think, correctly anticipated what Flick was going to do, that he wasn't going to change, was going to be the same system. And he sent out his team to avail of that, because it was a totally counter-attacking lineup from PSG. It didn't need to be as counter-attacking as it was. And when I say counter-attacking, I mean 7 defenders and 3 attackers. That's what the team was. It was like, we're not even really going to compete. We're not going to try to compete in terms of playing the game, sort of dictating the game, like the way they did against Leipzig. You know what I mean? Against Leipzig, PSG dominated the ball. They dominated the game, and they kind of tried to play on the front foot. But in this game, that was not going to be the idea. It was the only attacking really that they did was to sort of chase Bayern a little bit in their own half with the forwards. You know, hope to force an error, and they did succeed in doing that a couple of times. But they weren't going to try to actually play the game in Bayern's half in any meaningful way. Like the template for PSG, in a way you could say, maybe resembled Liverpool a little bit, in the sense of you've got these 3 very good forwards, and then you've got 3 much more solid sort of midfielders. But what they didn't have was sort of attacking fullbacks the way Liverpool have. Instead, PSG had Bernat, who obviously was trashed that time by Uli Hoeneß. This guy cost us the Champions League. We sold him. We immediately decided we were going to sell him because he was so shit. You know, he said unbelievably insulting things about Bernat, who obviously was primed for revenge and couldn't make it happen. And Thilo Kehrer, the other fullback, who actually emerged as one of the main villains, I guess, of the night for PSG, in terms of he was the guy they kind of scored on him. He was the guy who was caught under the ball. But the idea was, okay, we know the space. We know where the space is. We're not going to try and play. We're going to try and get through quickly, get in behind, and let's see what we can do. And they kicked off, and that's exactly what happened in the game. And PSG's plan worked, and Neymar had a chance, and Di Maria had a chance, and Mbappe had a chance, and they all missed their chances. And Bayern are the champions of Europe.
Well, Richie's on today for the first time since he went on the attack last week, saying what all the other pundits were afraid to say about PSG's Qatari owners. He's on with Jonathan Wilson. And it's a big week coming up here at Second Captains, because our brand new international investigative podcast series with BBC Sounds is ready to go. Episode one of Where Is George Gibney? It's coming out this Thursday, August 27th.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Well, now to a very special person tonight, a very special person in my life. Would you therefore please welcome George Gibney? Thank you very much.
You can't just go along with the wave if you want to make exceptional progress.
George Gibney was a star in Ireland in the 80s and the early 90s. He was an internationally renowned swimming coach at two Olympic Games in 84 and 88.
George, we've seen it in the papers recently. You've been offered all these marvellous jobs. You're not going to leave your Irish babies, are you?
And he was popular. He was a mover and shaker amongst politicians with a mid-Atlantic accent, tan and dark-rimmed glasses.
I have got the offers. They've been very attractive, but I really believe that we can do it. With Irish swimmers here can make medals in Barcelona, and I want to stay here to make sure that that happens.
And he loved publicity.
Well, let's hope. There's a few out there who want you to stay. There's no doubt about that.
But Gibney had a dark secret.
Mr. Gibney has denied the allegations of sexual abuse which were made against him in yesterday's Sunday Tribune and repeated by most newspapers today.
It was the greatest illusion that was perpetrated in sport ever. There was nothing about that man that was real.
George Gibney faced 27 charges of sexual abuse of young swimmers, but never even stood trial. Instead, he vanished.
I see a car, I see a face, I see a bird, I see glasses. When I'm not able to run from home, well, what's actually going to happen?
He came here and he said, no, this is all false, you know. I stood his bail, actually. I thought he was being falsely accused.
He was over here, he had to come over here to pick up his green card. And I've never seen him a day since.
This is a story that extends over decades and continents. There were rumours of Gibney on religious trips to Peru, of sightings in Thailand, of him hiding in Scotland.
Mr. Gibney was apparently hiding in a nearby supermarket before being smuggled in.
After not setting foot in Ireland for over 25 years, I retrace his steps across the US.
Gibney works with children in his parish, and he also coached at the North Jeffco Swim Club in Colorado.
They absolutely would have records of John Gibney working there.
Sure. John or George. Yeah. He uses both.
I remember thinking he was going to kill me, and then I remember when he grabbed me, knowing he's not going to kill me, I'm going to kill him.
But she's like, hey, Google this. She told me George instead of John, and I'm like, why? And she's like, just Google it. I'm not going to tell you, just Google it. I knew it.
So how has he escaped justice for so many years? And where is he now?
Do you recognize this guy?
No.
No. Never heard the name George Gibney before.
So yeah, some bad guy you're looking for.
You don't happen to recognize that guy, do you?
George Gibney?
Yeah, that's right.
I've spent the past 2 years trying to find out.
Hey, look.
Yeah, that's the boys.
That's the two boys. There they are. Just keep your head down. I think George Gibney's in the front of that car. Okay, are you ready to do it?
Yeah.
Where is George Gibney? Coming August 27th to BBC Sounds.
Now, I hope that has piqued your interest for Where is George Gibney? Written and produced by Mark Horgan and Kieran Cassidy. Episode 1 is out this Thursday, and the episodes will be released weekly every Thursday after that. It's super easy to listen in. Just search for Where is George Gibney wherever you usually get your podcasts. So that's via whatever podcast player you like to use. It's free to everyone. It's accessible worldwide for everyone, and you can subscribe now if you want in advance of the first episode. If you're listening to this in the UK, by the way, the best way to listen is via the BBC Sounds app. So this all kicks off this Thursday. Could not be more excited about all that. Now, Ken, report on some sport, please.
Yeah, I mean, I imagine it must be very frustrating for Thomas Tuchel to have lost the game in that way, because particularly for somebody like him who kind of, I don't want to say fancies himself a bit, because that sounds like, you know, I'm saying that he's like a vain a vain and silly, egotistical man. But, you know, I think he is definitely, he's obviously, he's a coach. You know, he's not a, it's not like Thomas Tuchel was a great player back in the day. He is a coach. And I think he's someone who believes in the role of the coach. Like, he's someone who believes that the coach can really bring an extra dimension to a team and isn't just a person, a kind of a symbolic or ceremonial figure, you know, who stands on the sideline.
I think that's fair enough, isn't it? Well,
I mean, yeah, but it depends, though. It depends what sort of level of team are we talking about? Because I think that I think PSG has always been the sort of wrong team for him in that it's not really a coach's team, is it? It's like a team where the tone is going to be decided by the gigantic star players who are really what the club is all about. I mean, the entire strategy of the club is based around these players. It's not really about the coach. The job of the coach is more or less just to get on with them. And if the coach doesn't get on with them or does things that they don't like, the coach will be gone. You know what I mean? So you're not really in a position to kind of do anything to sort of assert your own authority in the manner that Tuchel, I think, has been used to. In fact, Tuchel has been so used to that people tend to tire of him very quickly, or at least that has been his experience at his past clubs. Tuchel, like, telling everyone what to do the whole time causes people to eventually be like, you know what, why don't you just... Maybe it might be time for you to move on with this amazing career you're having. So I feel as though he might be really quite frustrated to have lost the Champions League final. And who knows if he'll ever be back in a Champions League final. But to have lost the one that he definitely did get to play in with such a basic game plan. You know what I mean? It's like, oh, I kind of can't believe I was associated with that. You know that sort of way? Like, I mean, you just sort of feel as though... If you get to the Champions League final, you'd like to be able to show your best stuff. And really, you know, that wasn't it. Like, I can just imagine Tuchel, like, you should see some of the stuff my Dortmund team played. Like, it was just absolutely amazing. You know, compared to that nonsense, that, like, French school nonsense, you know, kick the ball to the fast lads and hopefully they will do the rest. Mm. And then they can't do the rest. Ultimately, you know, it's like, it's, will Tuchel still be the manager on Saturday? Saturday, they're playing on Saturday in the league, which again is just seems really unfair. Like to lose the Champions League final and then to have to play the league game 6 days later.
Oh, of course, because sure they cancel it. Yeah, so they're straight into their new season.
The season is back. Well, I mean, everyone's straight into the new season though. It's Community Shield on Saturday as well.
I know.
And then, of course, there's an international break. In fact, Stephen Kenny's doing a press conference today to announce the squad for that, which we will be reacting to tomorrow, I think. But yeah, Ireland are going to be playing Bulgaria in Bulgaria. So there's a couple of international games in between that and the start of the season. But, you know, PSG are going to have to go back and, you know,
back to the drawing board. But just on the Hansi Flick side of that, do you think that when he's weighing up the pros and cons of whether to stick to his guns or to try to be a bit more conservative, whatever way you want to phrase it, that part of his thinking might be, okay, I'm up against Neymar and Mbappe, grand, but is it the real Mbappe? I mean, maybe he knew that if a chance, it couldn't be as specific as this, if a chance fell to Mbappe, he might miss it, but he does know that it's not the same Mbappe that generally terrorizes defenses. And also, maybe he looked in the eyes of his goalkeeper before the game and he thought, he didn't have to say anything. He saw Manuel Neuer. Manuel Neuer knew this was a day to perform as he can when he's at his very best. And when he's like that, you don't really score goals past him anyway.
Yeah, well, look at the size of this guy.
Yeah.
Like,
did you see his Superman celebration after saving the chance in the second half towards the end, which was offside anyway? I think it was from Mbappe. There's a little bit of showboating, you know, stony face. I'm saying Manuel Neuer was up for it, and maybe Flick knew that before. He saw something in training during the week and he thought, I can let these lads loose on Neuer and they're still not going to score.
Yeah, well, it certainly helps when Mbappe, the Mbappe's shot is weak as water. You know, like, that was the most stunning moment of the game for me when it was Alaba, I think, who gave the ball, passed it straight to Mbappe. And Mbappe then decided not to shoot immediately, but instead gave it to Herrera, who gave it straight back to him. And this time he's got a clear shot, and you expect this is a goal, and he just didn't catch the ball at all. And it's one of the easiest saves Neuer made. The save Neuer made from Neymar was brilliant. You know, that was like, you know, you expect that to be a goal, and he managed to just catch it as it passed under his body. Didn't leave a ball-sized gap between himself and the grass, which was good technical goalkeeping, I guess. Same, you know, again with the save, the one that he saved with his leg in the second half. Angel Di Maria, obviously, the chance fell on his chocolate leg, so he didn't need to save that one. But like, I mean, this was, you know, I suppose you just have to maybe accept that you need to be lucky as well in a final, and that if you're going to win, it's because you're going to have been lucky at some point. You know what I mean? You have to sort of factor that in rather than try to control every detail. I'm not trying to just make this all a big dig at Pep Guardiola.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to mention there is a lot of subtweeting going on here. I mean, this might be 20 minutes of subtweeting here.
But you know, it is. It sort of is. Like I mean, it's a dilemma that every coach has to face. Like, you know, what are you going to do? Like, are you going to try and do something to counteract them, or are you just going to concentrate on what you're doing yourself? I'm not saying that the Flick didn't do anything at all. I mean, you know, of course, but like, he definitely didn't compromise the basic aspects of Bayern's game, as certainly Wayne Rooney would have been encouraging him to do. You know what I mean? As lots of people would have felt, oh, come on, you know, you've faced facts here, man. Like,
yeah, and like for all the discussion about the fact that, you know, that PSG made the chances, they just couldn't finish them. There's also the possibility that Bayern Munich completely changed their game, that all those changes work, and that Neymar still sticks one in the top corner from 30 yards. Like, you are dealing with, absolutely, you know, like, really top quality, world class players. And like, if they want to score and they do something absolutely out of this world, like, that's a thing that could very easily happen as well. So, you know, you might as well do the Hansi Flick and just, right, we'll just do us.
We walk in the valley of the shadow of death, but we will fear no evil, right?
Yeah. That's exactly it,
Ken. I'm just looking at the keep ratings.
They're usually generous, right?
Who's their man of the match?
Their man of the match.
Poor.
Kingsley Coman?
He's number two. He gets 8, along with Thiago, who also gets 8. But the man of the match gets 9, and that's Manuel Neuer. Which I think is a fair reflection of the game. Neymar, Mbappe, and Thilo Kehrer are the lowest scorers in the game with 3 each. I mean, that's harsh enough, I would have thought. Like, 3?
It's very harsh on Neymar. I didn't think he was that bad.
3. I mean, Kehrer was, you know, there was he got done by Coman, didn't he? Is it a penalty? Is it not a penalty just before halftime? He obviously was the guy who was caught under the ball for the winning goal. Although again, you know, if you look at it, they're outnumbered in their own 6-yard box at that point.
Oh, there were so many. There was five
Bayern players in the box.
One of the pundits was making the point that's where the sort of adventurous spirit comes in, where you get that many players. It looks more like a free kick where the players have had time to come forward and stand in the box, you know, but it's actually open play. They decide to get 5 or 6 players.
Yeah, and the, and you know, PSG, what are you going to do? Like, there's too many. I mean, the reason that Thilo Kehrer is caught under the ball is because he sees Robert Lewandowski in front of him, and he's like, oh no, Lewandowski's going to score. And then the ball comes over his head. It's like, oh no, there's a guy behind me as well. You know, it's like, anyway, the keeper, like, 3. Thomas Tuchel, he of the, well, I mean, look, I'm just, you know, I'm just the coach. Like, I don't actually get to decide anything. He gets 4. Maybe they felt that he could have done more. You know, he could have tried to play a more creative game. I mean, he had the options to do that. He had players like Verratti. You know, he said before the game, Verratti can't play for 120 minutes. But maybe Verratti could have started and played an hour. He had Draxler, but instead he went for, you know, Paredes, Marquinhos, and Herrera in midfield. Again, keep it tight. That was his plan. I'm sure it's going to be big regrets for him. I wonder, is he going to be gone now? I think he probably should leave, to be honest, because he's been there long enough. And it's like, why? It's just not the right club for him, I don't think. Which may seem stupid, you know, in the sense that he's just got to a Champions League final. And clearly, it's a club that gives you a chance as a coach of winning the biggest titles. And isn't that what every coach wants? That and a gigantic income, which I'm sure it also provides. But I don't really feel as though he's given a platform there to show, to fulfill his own potential. You know, he can maybe be there winning things and making a lot of money, but I don't really think he's being Thomas Tuchel, if you know what I mean.
But then what sort of coach do they want long term? Are we saying they want the facilitator then, that they move away? Because the attraction of a coach like him, I presume, is that he can put tactical manners on on those PSG superstars. And in fairness, I think a lot of people have been making the point that the work rate seems to be up, and that you know, he does demand and apparently get more in general play maybe from Neymar in particular. But is that what we're saying, that okay, that's all grand, but nah, forget it, you just want somebody to stand there and allow them to do what they want?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, I think would be the best manager for them. I'm kind of surprised they haven't tried to hire him already. The reason they haven't tried to hire him already is they were waiting for this story to come to a close. But if I'm PSG, I'm right now on the phone to Maurizio Pochettino. I think that Pochettino, remember, he is a former PSG player. He was part of their previous exciting team, or not, they obviously had an exciting team in the mid-90s with sort of Georgie Weah and David Gilla and these types of players. But they also, the Ronaldinho era PSG, Pochettino was part of that team. And I think that he has got the sorts of qualities that they're looking for, in terms of, he is both tactically a very sharp manager, but he's also the kind of manager who like tears off his shirt and like cries with the players. You know what I mean? And I
that's
honestly
very
think
important
that
to you, is it?
Well, I think, you know, the kind of guy I'm talking about, this sort of guy who can really connect with his players on a sort of visceral, like crying,
shirtless
manly,
level
manly
on a shirtless
level.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Like jumping into the shower with the players and them not thinking it was weird. Like, this is what I'm talking about. You know, I just think Pochettino has got that.
Like Roy Hodgson. Yeah, got it.
Well, you know, like you see the Thomas Tuchel sitting there on like a cool box or whatever, and he just does. He look like, you know.
My wife was very upset that they didn't just put a chair out for him. I mean, why not just have a chair? It's like, nah, you can't. Like, what kind of chair?
That is a good point.
What kind of chair would you have? Would it be like a little boy's own, kind of like a high stool? You know?
Well, that's the thing. Maybe he thought the chair would just bring such an air of bathos. You know, like Steve McLaren's umbrella.
Yeah.
It would
be
like an inappropriate thing to have. Whereas a cool box is like, well, he's kind of a bit like Marcel Bielsa, right?
Yeah.
I mean, doesn't he sit on one of those things sometimes?
A cool box belongs somewhere in the vicinity of the dugout. So, I mean,
it's
doesn't
sporting
look...
Sporting
stuff. Yeah. Whereas the chair would just be like, well, like, what kind of chair would you... I mean...
It just makes you even more out of place. Like, like a monocle, you know. So yeah, but Pochettino, you know, come on, like, what's not to like? I mean, this guy, he ticks every box, you know, connection with the club, you know, high level tactical stuff, but also like chest beating manliness, you know, kind of charisma in that sort of sense, you know, believes in magical things, sure.
Lemons.
But, you know, ultimately, is that really that much of a black mark? I honestly don't know why he isn't already the coach. He's the guy I would hire, but let's wait and see what happens. Bayern, obviously the champions. Lewandowski season, by the way, top scorer in every competition. 34 and 31 Bundesliga, 15 in 10 in the Champions League. Also the top assister in the Champions League.
Whoa.
6 goals in 5 in the German Cup. Obviously they won all those competitions, 47 games, 55 goals. But obviously they had to cancel the Ballon d'Or this year. I mean, what? Like, it's just crazy. Like, why do they have to cancel it? Oh, there's a level playing field or whatever.
Lads,
no one
it's
would
the
have been...
Ballon d'Or. Like, Jesus, come on. You know, it's not like there's like a hard and fast set of rules here.
Yeah, no one else would have been winning that this season anyway, apart from this guy. You know, with a record like that, winning the treble, you know, there's just no doubt about it. Like, he's even getting it on the sort of longevity basis. You know, he would even be getting it on the Ryan Giggs. You've been here this long, you know, you deserve one at this stage. But like, he has genuinely had an absolute outstanding. Instead, there's just going to be a gap there where it should be his year. Like, it's just, I hope he doesn't, I hope he's not a bitter man. I mean, he's got a lot of actual trophies and titles and glory and all that kind of stuff too.
I think he'd be all right.
But, you know, it must rankle a little bit. Like, this is totally unfair and nonsense. But look, okay. The Europa League final obviously was Friday. We didn't get a chance to speak about it. Inter end up losing to Sevilla, who win the competition as usual. Lukaku, the hero of the competition, scores the winning own goal. A disaster. And then Antonio Conte is needled into completely losing his rag by Ever Banega, who accuses him of having a wig and is rubbing his head in an insulting manner. Did you see the footage of Conte going mad on the sideline with Banega?
No.
Oh my God, it's terrible.
There's a way for this, yeah.
Oh, that thing in your head is a phony, and it comes from the tail of a pony. was very much Ever Banega's message.
Wow.
Is that a hairstyle, or is that a hairdo, or is that a wig, huh? And then he's like rubbing his hair, his head, in a sort of suggestive manner to make sure that everybody understands the content of this exchange. Yeah, is in the stadium.
I was going to say, like, he's not like he's the hardest man to needle into volcanic rage. But I mean, that is properly annoying from Antonio Conte's point of view. I mean,
no, but you know, not as annoying when you consider what's been going on in Antonio Conte's life, which is to say, an ongoing war, as usual, against his club directors, which is probably going to end in his departure from the club. But even worse than that, I mean, he's used to that. That's just normality. There's a story in La Repubblica, the Italian newspaper, that Conte has lost 30 million euros in a fraud, in a scam. This, as Google Translate tells me, the La Repubblica article, an alleged scam with a rudimentary scheme, like the one told by the unscrupulous financier played by Matthew McConaughey in the film Wolf of Wall Street. Take the client's money and put it in your pocket. Actually, I had to refresh my memory on the line. I was like, is that what the line said? Name of the game, move the money from the client's pocket into your pocket. Is what Matthew McConaughey tells Leonardo DiCaprio at their dinner early in
their seminal dinner.
Yes. The alleged scammer, who was frozen by an English commercial court of 61.4 million euros, is 54-year-old Massimo Bocchicchio, owner of several investment companies in Great Britain. Among those who had entrusted him with their money, there would also be the Inter coach Antonio Conte, who claims from Bocchicchio non-payments of 30.6 million euros.
Jesus.
So basically, investors, including Conte, expected payments with the return of the capital plus the yield by 30th of June last to be divided according to the shares paid. The money did not arrive. The injured went to the court asking for urgent protection, pending more in-depth investigation into the case. So it appears they've seized some assets off the guy. So maybe, hopefully, Antonio Conte will be getting... getting some of his money back. But in the meantime, you can imagine just how annoyed, how irritated he must have been, even before Ever Banega started rubbing his head and hurling that gutter abuse at him as he lost the Europa League final on Friday night.
All right, just as you finish your report on sport, Ken, I see Stephen Kenny has named this squad, so we might as well get some reaction in to this podcast. You have a little look at that. I'll wrap the report on sport now.
After bed, I went.
My head was fried.
I didn't even know there was a damn card in the thing.
Fucking
horror. I was
horror.
Devastated.
I'd been off the smokes a while.
Hard full.
Saw that. Back on them.
I had a date organised for that night. A first date with someone. Cancelled that.
My head was gone.
Woke up the following morning and to my absolute amazement, I read this message on my phone.
Let me tell you, you're only getting this because you're a former player of mine, and I'm not too sure too many journalists would have got the third time lucky.
Hi Richie, sorry the equipment didn't work again, but it's no problem for me to do it again. Maybe see you in Ipswich one day for third time lucky. Best wishes, Mick. Best wishes, Mick.
I got a job on a Wednesday. I'd been a player up until that Wednesday. Took the training on Thursday. I picked the team on Friday and I took the game on Saturday, so. I got the job on a Wednesday. I'd been a player up until that Wednesday. Took the training on Thursday. Picked the team on Friday and I took the game on Saturday, so. It was a bit of a whirlwind.
Oh, God. Oh, Jesus Christ.
Well, I'm just looking down. I think all the red lights are still on. It looks like we've recorded this successfully. Mick, thank you so much for agreeing to do this so many times.
Richie, I sincerely hope so, because there's no fourth time lucky, let me tell you.
One of the podcasts together for the first time since, I believe, a Liberty Hall show a couple of years ago. It's Richie and Jonathan Wilson. Hi, Jonathan. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad, thanks. Were we not on together about a month ago?
Oh, well, it slipped my mind, Jonathan. But listen, this is, you know.
We obviously made an impact.
How are you, Richie?
How are you, Owen? Well,
I must have been off that day. That's my excuse. We were talking a little bit about how this final matched up, Richie, to the hype beforehand. You know, there's a lot of fevered anticipation of a 4-3 thriller and all the rest of it. If you forget about what it was hyped up to be and just take it as a game, you know that thing that you hear said all the time? If you were an alien, Richie, you'd been beamed down and this was the first ever game of football you ever saw, would you have thought that was a decent enough game?
I thought it was. I think I probably enjoyed the first half more than the second half. I didn't come into it with massive expectations, because I think we've had such a run of so many good Champions League games this season, and we've had a run of so many poor Champions League finals over the years. I thought, you know, lower my expectations here, and given all that, I thought it was decent enough. I didn't expect it to be a glut of goals. I thought it would be a bit more cagey than that, but overall, I enjoyed it without being wowed off my seat.
Jonathan, were you wowed off your seat, in Richie's words?
Probably not quite, but I thought the first half was really high quality, really high intensity, really high pace. I was mystified by the commentators on BT and by the reaction of sort of half of Twitter calling it a cagey game. I mean, it certainly wasn't cagey. You know, both sides were attacking. They might not have been attacking particularly effectively, but yeah, there were, well, PSG had four decent chances in the first half, Bayern three. I don't know. I mean, there's more to good football than goals.
Well, I agreed with you that the first half was better than the second. But what was there anything that you noticed to change there in terms of, did Bayern, was that in any way Bayern's doing? Did they somehow make themselves more secure in the second half? I kind of wish it had kept going the way it was before halftime, but obviously it didn't.
I'm not sure if it's anything tactical, but what I think was noticeable was that PSG tired pretty badly in the second half. And you know, the first two players who were substituted were Paredes and Herrera, who were having to do a huge amount of running. And although lots has been made of how Neymar looks more defensively committed this season than he has done perhaps in the past, he didn't make a single successful tackle or interception last night. And Thomas Müller, the long-armed Thomas Müller, regained the ball more than the entire PSG front line, which I think then puts pressure on the midfield, and so they get worn out. And I think that, as much as anything else, is why Bayern were able to take control after half time.
Is that a situation, Richie, do you think, in which having a stadium half full of PSG supporters might have actually helped them a little bit? Because I was just wondering what you made of the fact that the players in general, and not just in this final eight tournament, you know, which has been pretty good to watch, I think, despite the fact that this has been taking place in empty stadiums in circumstances which only a few months ago we would have considered completely ludicrous. Actually, the players have adapted to this just fine. It barely seems as though the fans not being there makes any difference at all.
I wonder, and I suppose every player would give a different answer, and I was really interested to try and gauge from a distance what impact, with the obvious exception of the noise or the visual spectacle, that not having fans there would impact on the performance. And I think after a while, I was speaking to Vinnie Perth, the Dundalk manager over the week, well, recently former Dundalk manager, and he was saying it took them a few games to just to get used to it and to adapt to the fact that whatever however you normally interact with the fact that there are thousands of people watching you, and the noise or the abuse or the support or the encouragement or the jeering or the mocking or whatever, whether you feel the stress or anxiety or whether you just look upon it as a source of a fuel for more energy, you just find your own way. And he said different players found it in different ways, but after a couple of games of adjusting to it, he said it wasn't noticeable after a while. So I say the same would be true of the players at this level as well. I think you I suppose just give more focus to your job. There's no external factors to have to deal with. There's obviously the expectation or the knowledge that there's a worldwide audience in a match of last night's stature, but I think it probably just simplifies your job a little bit on the pitch. There are no conditions that you have to adjust to. You just have to go out and do the thing you're there to do.
What about as a spectacle, Jonathan? Brian Kerr said afterwards on Irish TV that, you know, he seemed a bit grimed out by the post-match stuff, the fact that there's no fans for the players to do their lap of honour in front of and all that kind of stuff. But I don't know, it's kind of, certainly in the full-time whistle, they reacted exactly the same way they would if there were 80,000 fans in the stadium. And there are certain moments, like I quite liked how you get a chance to actually see Oliver Kahn walk down, and I think possibly teary-eyed, have a little embrace with Manuel Neuer, these two great German Bayern Munich goalkeepers, stuff like that, which often wouldn't get picked out because there's so much pandemonium at the full-time whistle. You do get a chance to see. I mean, I might be bigging this up a little bit too much. It probably is. It's obviously better with fans there, but it certainly, I don't get the sense that the players, whatever Ander Herrera and others say, seem to be too put out, seem to feel it any, certainly didn't look like Bayern Munich enjoyed that occasion any less, the players, than they would have if the fans had been there.
Yeah, they didn't appear to. I mean, I don't know. It's that's the first Champions League final I haven't been at since 2002, so I don't know what the Champions League final normally looks like on telly. So I'm maybe not the right person to sort of to judge that. Or you know, equally, had I been in the stadium last night, I would have had a better answer there. But I sort of when the Bundesliga first came back, and that obviously was slightly odd and slightly grating. I sort of flippantly said, oh, this is sort of football's Daumen 95 moment, you know, the Lars von Trier thing of not using any special effects, not using any background music, sort of focusing on the pure filmmaking. And although I sort of said that as a joke, I've increasingly come to think it's sort of true. You end up focusing way more on the actual football and on the emotions of the people immediately involved than this sort of backdrop, which I guess it's more than a backdrop, but you know, there's no cutaways to the crowd, to the, I don't know, the cop in full voice or the celebrities at PSG or whatever. And so, I don't know. I think it does make you, and especially if you have it without crowd noise, and you can hear the shouts of players and coaches, even if you can't fully, you know, even if it was in English, you couldn't fully distinguish what was being said. You get some idea of tone. And I think that has brought the emphasis back on the football for better or for worse.
So we're agreed, fans out, Ken. I'm sure this conversation will go down well.
Well, I do wonder actually what the long-term effects of that are going to be. Like, first of all, would the players miss the fact that they can actually hear each other? I mean, I suppose they can hear each other a bit.
When the fans come back in, yeah.
Yeah, when they're back, I mean, obviously there's all the sort of abuse and stuff that fans bring, the tone of anger, taking the focus away from the game. The fact, Richie, that you can't hear each other may once again become resented by players. But I also wonder if maybe it does break the link a little bit with between supporters on the game. I mean, you know, just if what this development means sort of for the future of the game, the fact that it seems like football can get on well without fans, well, it's kind of like, well, maybe we can get on without you as well.
Well, obviously it does break a link. It puts an enormous physical distance between players and fans. The only link now is through the medium of television or whatever tweets players put out on social media. I'm trying to imagine myself being a player in that scenario. I think it would do maybe probably wonders for something as, you know, very abstract, but something like team unity. Like you're not, there is no supporting cast. There's nobody in the stand who you're going to turn to rely on to get more energy out of yourself or more encouragement. And I think like the scenes of celebration last night that we've seen from the players, like they're celebrating with one another. There's no one going off on a solo run kind of up to to thousands of people in a stand. They're just embracing each other and sharing the moment when, with one another. And I think that's, you know, given the fact that, you know, they don't have a choice for the fans to be there, given that they accept that the fans are not going to be there, I think that that would be, I don't know, I'd imagine that would be pretty pleasing, just to share, to be able to share the occasion with the people that, that you've achieved it with. So it's a scenario that a couple of months ago, I mean, I would have thought, like, what's the point? Like, really, what is the point in trying to do this and excluding all fans? But given that fans being there just is not an option for loads of understandable reasons, I think in the main, I think it's been really, really good.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Jonathan, when you looked when you look at the game last night, I mean, if there's a grand narrative out of the game, maybe it is that, you know, in a final, it pays to be brave. You know, not to the kind of story of Bayern Munich's success in this game is Hansi Flick deciding not to be scared out of using his usual tactics by the big teeth on PSG. And I kind of wonder, you know, given that this success, like Flick's success, is basically let's just keep doing what we're doing and let them worry about us. It's sort of so much the opposite of you know, Guardiola, who obviously had a total nightmare in this tournament, and that Bayern was this, you know, very highly touted manager who never made it this far and who would always kind of try to come up with something for the big games, unlike Flick. That, okay, is it the case, are we, if we look all around Europe, is it the case that big teams don't need big coaches with big brains and big plans for big games? They've already got big players. So what they really need is a guy to pat those players on the ass as they go out and to say, go on, lads. You know, that this is what Flick was able to do better than Tuchel. This is actually, if you look at Jurgen Klopp, this is actually his key skill rather than any of the kind of higher end football brain stuff. Zidane's been doing it and winning this competition for years. That's what management at the very, very top level, I'm not talking about the level just below the top level, I mean the very, very top super club level, that's what it's all about.
I think there's a lot of separate threads have tangled together there. clearly motivation is important, and clearly players feeling comfortable with the coach is important. I think Flick Flick was clearly part of the brains behind Yogi Löw. I think you can see elements of what made Germany really good, certainly in 2014, in this Bayern side, that when they do regain the ball, they seem to have a very, very clear idea, very clear patterns of play, which again is something that I think Jurgen Klopp's really good at, is those... I think the best analogy, from what I'm aware of, the first team to really have these sort of pre-practice moves, these sort of set ways of breaking, was Dynamo Kiev under Lobanovsky. And his great collaborators, you know, the sort of computer geek who did all the sciencey side, Anatoly Zelentsov, he said people misunderstood what that meant. It wasn't sort of by rote. It wasn't sort of this is what you know, it's, you just do these things. He said it was more like a gambit in chess, that sort of this is the basic format on which you then extemporize. I think you can see the link between, you know, the great Germany of the early part of the decade and this Bayern, and Flick is and Müller and Neuer and Boateng, obviously as well. You know, there is a spine of players as well as a coach, but I think he's restored that. But I think the point that's actually really interesting is this idea of not needing the big name coach. Brain size, I think it's quite hard to tell from our perspective, but in terms of not needing the big name, and I think it's something that Raphael Honigstein said the other day, that Germany seems very happy with the notion of these sort of technocrats who are allowed to get on and do their job without anybody saying, yeah, but what did you win? And yet that goes very much against what we've seen with, for instance, Juventus appointing Pirlo.
Well, hang on a second, though. In Germany is producing these star coaches like no other country at the moment. I mean, obviously, Klopp, Tuchel is one of them, and Nagelsmann, you know, is like the sort of the most outrageous coaching star, surely, yet.
But they're star coaches for their coaching, whereas Pirlo's coaching experience is 9 days with the under-23s, in which his one act appears to have been going watching under-19s play away at Monza.
Well, we haven't seen his Coverciano thesis yet, but okay, fair enough. He hasn't done much coaching.
Has he actually finished his thesis yet?
I don't know.
Quite.
I haven't seen the thesis.
The idea that, yeah, certainly the story coming out of Juventus was, oh, Ronaldo can't sort of take Sarri seriously, just as he couldn't take Benitez seriously, because he's never won the Ballon d'Or, he's never been involved in a World Cup winning team, he doesn't know what it's like to play at the highest level. Jeremy doesn't seem to have any of those hang-ups. He just says he's a guy, good coach, yes he is, brilliant, get on with it. Zidane, I think, is a sort of interesting mix, that he obviously does have a status as a player, and in a slightly understated way, he doesn't have the sort of grand philosophy of a Guardiola or a Klopp, and that may be a personality thing, that he just doesn't sort of preach that doctrine. But it's become apparent over time that he's sort of from the non-pressing school. He's from that French school which Deschamps still subscribes to, of keeping things relatively tight and hoping the talent to be forward is enough, which, it's particularly in knockout competition, it has been.
Richie, you made your feelings on Paris Saint-Germain and their ownership perfectly clear on national television last week, but
I actually didn't. There was no opinion in my piece.
Mm-hmm.
I was asked just...
Well, there wasn't. Didn't you say PSG are even worse than RBL?
And PSG, far worse, is they're run by a regime which faces allegations of anything from torturing journalists to imprisoning gay people and a host of other human rights abuses.
Is that a big statement?
It was big enough to get a big reaction, wasn't it?
That allegations of that kind of, those kind of crimes, is to use my phrase, far worse than maybe being a bit creative about getting around fan membership.
Why did you think, actually, Richie? Why were you surprised by the fact that it got something like 3 million views on the RT?
It's ridiculous. Completely ridiculous.
So what was your thoughts on that?
How it came about? So we were, as we do in every show, we have a meeting an hour or two beforehand. We work out, how much actual studio talk time do we have when we remove ad breaks and competitions or pre-recorded interviews with whoever, and we know the time that UEFA insists we have to go over to the stadium at, and then we just work out what's worthy of a mention here, and we'd have three or four pieces of analysis, and then we had a chat where we also, is there anything around the game that's worth mentioning? And I just asked beforehand, are we going to refer to the club ownership issue? And the producer and Darren Maloney, the presenter, myself and Duffer, we just tease it out, and there are some scenarios where more than one of the pundits might have something to say, or we might have differing views on certain topics, and we go, okay, we'll get into that on air. Don't give your views now, because we want to have a natural exchange of views on air. But in this one, I just thought it was worth just referring to it, and then let's just move on. So we agreed beforehand, like Duffer wasn't going to come in and say anything afterwards, but I obviously didn't realise he was going to get that reaction during the show. I look at my phone the other time during a match, and I thought, geez, a couple of people have retweeted this or people are saying, and then it just kept going and going and going and going. But there wasn't actually any opinion in it for me. I just answered the question that Dara asked, which is, can you maybe explain why these are wildly unpopular in certain areas?
Well, what did you... So you're telling us you weren't cheering on Bayern last night then?
Oh, I was.
Oh, you were. Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. Well, it's always this thing in football, like, because particularly when you're in the job we have in RTE, you there's so many different areas to focus on a game before a game is played. Like, do you care about a managerial contract situation or the personal ambitions of a player who's about to leave, or like something like the historical, like how a club was founded or how it's funded or what the owners do when they're not owning the club. Like, to a lot of people, that's just boring. I'm not here to see that. Just shut up and talk about the football. So you always have to be mindful of that as well. But we just felt that it was just worthy of referring to it and mentioning it, because it was particularly, I find stuff like that particularly interesting. But so save me a little 60 seconds, and then it just took off.
Jonathan, what about the argument that, where are you on PSG? Were you glad to see them not reach the promised land?
I suppose so. But, you know, we shouldn't overlook the fact that Bayern, since 2018, have been sponsored by Qatar Airways. Qatar Airways was promoting this as the Qualassico, so Classico with a Q at the front. So, you know, the Qatar's second team won. Brilliant. And, you know, the winners scored by somebody with a conviction for wife beating. So it was a pretty dark day for football all around. But it's also, I almost think it's, you know, the battle's lost. You know, it doesn't, whether PSG won it or not, they're there. You know, they're a great team. They're a huge club. If there is a Super League, they will be part of it. When FIFA's 2014 Club World Cup, if they ever find space for it in the calendar, when that happens, PSG will be part of it. They are this enormous brand. And while obviously that would be capped off by winning the Champions League, and I'm sure the Emir would like to sort of dance about with the trophy, that's a tiny little bit on top. They are there now at the heart of football. They've got the World Cup in 2022. They've won the Asian Cup. Qatar has very successfully used sport to help burnish its reputation. Now, it's also brought scrutiny of its human rights record, of the fact that homosexuality is still illegal there, of the lack of women's rights, the fact that domestic violence is not criminalised in Qatar, the appalling conditions of migrant workers, the kafala system, which, although it has been reformed, Human Rights Watch, I saw a report from earlier this month, where they're sort of expressing scepticism as to what the practical benefits of those reforms have been, given it doesn't seem to apply in the military, public or domestic spheres. But you know, when they bought the club in, or bought 70% of the club in 2011, and then they completed the takeover the following year, their stated aim was to make them a great team and a recognised brand. Well, they've absolutely achieved that, and if they saw that as being a worthwhile goal, then well, they've absolutely achieved it.
Just what about in the kind of more immediate term for PSG? I mean, they actually have to play a French league match on Saturday. Like, it's their season, the Ligue 1 season has already started. Of course, I think it's the Community Shield on Saturday as well. So things are coming around pretty quickly. But just in terms of the immediate future for the two big stars of the team, this is obviously a big disappointment. We saw Neymar had to be consoled by everybody. You know, everybody was... in terms of the determination he feels is matched by the sadness he feels when his aims are frustrated. Now, what do you think his what do you think is in his immediate future? Now, there was, for the last couple of years, it seemed as though he was quite keen to escape, but now not only do you doubt the ability of any team really looking around Europe to prize him away from PSG, given what that would cost. You'd almost wonder if there's any point. Like, if there's not going to be spectators at any games, it's sort of everywhere is kind of the same now, really. What is the advantage at this point of even trying? Like, for himself, for Neymar and Mbappe, they're as well off at PSG at this point as anywhere, really.
Well, unless they actually want to test themselves in a league where they're challenged in more than a handful of games a season, and if they think that being challenged would make them more likely to win the Champions League or more likely to win the Ballon d'Or, which...
So you're saying they should join the teams in the Premier League?
I'm saying I can understand why they wonder whether there are further mountains to scale. But, you know, I think the fundamental economic point you make is right. Who realistically can afford them or would want to take that gamble? I guess maybe Barcelona, because they're in such a mess and they know that Neymar would keep Messi happy. Maybe buy Neymar back as a way of keeping Messi there, and you sort of think of a front three with Griezmann between the two of them. Maybe that works, but I mean that would be an enormous gamble from Barcelona. And yeah, maybe with presidential elections, that's something that a presidential hopeful could offer. That, you know, if you elect me, I'll bring Neymar back. But yeah, I do wonder. You know, I've been fascinated by the way the coverage has gone with Neymar in the last 2 weeks. That there's been a very, very clear perception, certainly. Maybe I'm just saying this because I don't normally hear BT's commentary, Maybe that's the entire issue here. But there does seem to have been a lot of criticism of Neymar, this idea that, you know, he's somehow lazy, which I think is absolutely not the case, or that he bottles big games, which I also think is an oversimplification of a situation. And then there's sort of been a backlash against that, saying, no, he is a brilliant footballer. And clearly he is a brilliant footballer. But he does bring a lot of baggage. You know, the fact that he is... Yeah, and has, from being a teenager, been held up as the future of Brazilian football. I mean, I remember the first time I saw him live was at the Copa America in 2011, when, you know, all the hype around him was, yeah, he's the best since Pelé. And then, you know, I watched him get bullied by Paraguay twice and thought, yeah, I'm not sure about that yet. And that sort of has been the way of it all the way through, that sort of every major tournament, something's gone wrong and he's always sort of been... whether it's always been his fault, has been at the centre of it. And you sort of can almost feel the pressure weighing on him. And he now has the pressure of Qatari foreign policy weighing on him as well. So maybe for that reason he'd like to get out. And I think certainly he has shown signs of disillusionment. You know, it's pretty open secret. He wanted to leave last summer. I think he has played pretty well, certainly in the quarter and semi-final. I think he has worked harder, albeit he didn't actually win the ball back once on Sunday. But does that change of attitude continue when they're beating Troyes and Caen 7-8-0, and then suddenly they come up against, I don't know, Liverpool in the quarterfinals and get beaten next season? I don't know. Maybe he sort of feels that frustration, disillusionment again.
Richie, where are you, Neymar?
I actually really like him. I think. And I was guilty of this as well over the past, just reading the pieces that spoke about his personal life or his social life. And I just conjured up this image of a fella who just has really split priorities between doing what he should be doing on the pitch and just enjoying too much the celebrity stuff away from it, and whether the cost of all of that would just be too great, particularly the financial cost that comes with signing him. But I think he's... Like, I don't, like, pick your best, the list of the best strikers in the world. If money's no object and you could have anyone in your squad, he'd be in it. And I think the performances he gave in, not so much last night in front of goal particularly, but in the previous rounds as well, I think whatever stuff he brings off the field, it's more than justified by the stuff he can do on it. The concern I'd have, actually, just looking at PSG, is... I thought actually even before the round of 16 games were even completed, before the second legs, I thought they were in such a strong position. They were strong favourites to make the final, not because of the talent within the squad or the form of any one of their particular players, but because of the draw. They were going to avoid, like, the winners of Real or City and Barca and Juve and Bayern until the final. So that's the champions of Italy, the champions of Germany, the best team left in it from England, and the top two in Spain. We're all going to have to fight it out amongst themselves on the opposite side of the draw. And if PSG did their bit and got to the final, they would meet whoever left. So I thought I don't know, will a draw as favourable as that, is that likely to come up again? I mean, it's such a stroke of luck. So I think that I don't know if they'll have an opportunity to win it as they did this season. Again, for quite a while.
Richie, Jonathan, great to have the two of you together again so soon after the last time. Good to talk to you. Thanks a million.
Cheers, lads.
Cheers, thanks.
Fair to say, anybody could have managed those guys?
No, of course not.
It's about 12. Everyone in the city knew about it, but no one had seen him.
How happy I was. What the fuck happened? No, really. What happened?
It is not war and death and famine. It's not that at all. It's the opposite of that. It's the persuaders of the world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
There's just one point that Jonathan made there that I think probably requires a bit of further explanation concerning Bayern's match winner last night. So this relates to something that happened in 2017. Bayern Munich winger, I'm reading this from a couple of different publications at the time, Bayern Munich winger Kingsley Coman has accepted a charge of domestic violence against his former girlfriend and has been fined €5,000. Coman pleaded guilty to attacking model Sephora Goignan at her home outside Paris in June. Goignan, the mother of Coman's daughter, was signed off work for 8 days following the attack. Coman, who reportedly earned £62,000 a week, was also ordered to pay nominal damages of €1 to Ms. Goignan. So, yeah, well, that's the background there. Ken, the Republic of Ireland squad, Stephen Kenny's ready to make his mark.
Yes, and, well, what's the headline news? Well, it's some continuity, but also some new faces. Let me just go through the squad. Goalkeepers, Darren Randolph, Mark Travers, Kieran O'Hara. Defenders, Seamus Coleman, Matt Doherty, Enda Stevens, Shane Duffy, John Egan, Darragh Lenihan. Okay, so that's fairly, you know, as you were. Midfielders, James McCarthy, Harry Arter, Jeff Hendrick, Alan Brown, Connor Harahan, Jason Malumbi, and Robbie Brady. So that's Malumbi in, which is good news, I guess. Forwards, Callum Robinson, Callum O'Dowda, James McLean, Aaron Connolly, Adam Ida, Troy Parrott, and Shane Long. David McGoldrick of Sheffield United will join the squad for the Finland game.
Wow, Ken.
Okay, so that's pretty much it. Now, if you look at Mick McCarthy's last squad, there are players who were involved in that aren't involved in this one would include like Kevin Long, the defender from Burnley, last seen being beaten by Aaron Connolly for that goal. Kieran Clark isn't in this squad. I think Derek Williams was in the last squad, was in the previous. I'm talking about the November Denmark game. Josh Cullen is not there. Glenn Whelan obviously is not there. Jack Byrne is not there. Again, you know, I'm sure we'll be hearing from Stephen Kenny today as to his thoughts on these various selections. Scott Hogan is not there. James Collins hasn't made it. Sean Maguire. And Sean McGuire and Alan Judge are also missing. They were players who were in the previous squad that don't make it this time. Whereas guys who have made it in are obviously Parrott, Ida, Connolly was there already.
I think some of the more experienced guys are the interesting ones, actually, because we expect them to bring in the young lads, you know, mm-hmm. and to keep the young lads who are already there. But to bring James McCarthy back, Harry Arter's back, Shane Long's back.
Yes.
You know, these are guys who've multiple hundreds of caps between them practically. So that's interesting.
They're the ones that he's gone for. Arter's particularly interesting one, I guess, isn't he? Because, I mean, I'm not sure anyone was necessarily expecting him to be part of things. Again, though, you know, when I say that, I mean, on what basis am I saying that? Just because Harry Arter hasn't featured for a while, I've sort of forgotten about him, and I figure his age profile is like, well, I mean, he's not going to be around much longer. I mean, you know, Harry Arter, I guess Stephen Kenny might have been looking at things a little bit more closely. I'm sure we'll talk more about his decisions tomorrow.
If there are any dynamite quotes out of that today, we will react further tomorrow. Okay, thanks, Ken. Thanks, Kieran.
Thank you, Ken.
We're also going to talk about Katie Taylor's big win on tomorrow's podcast as well. So that's all on the way. Thanks for listening.
What phone is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys. It is not war and death and famine. It's not that at all. It's the opposite of that. It's to persuade that there's a world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.